is Claire Midgley interviewing Keith Thompson for the Dialects and Heritage Project on the 10th of May 2022. Could I ask you to introduce yourself?
Yeah. Hi, my name is Keith Thompson. I've lived in Gorthans for some 42 years or thereabouts. And I am at the moment the honorary president of Gorthan Ploughstots. If you will, it's a dead man's shoes job, but it's my turn now.
And do you live in the village now? Grew up in the village? Or?
No, I wasn't born in the village. My folks lived in the next village over. They lived between Gromont and Slights. I wasn't born and brought up here. We moved here, oddly enough, from Bankery in Scotland. It's a long, long story how we landed here, but we did. Primarily because we wanted our daughters to have a settled life, and instead of moving them round, so we took a bit of a hit financially and settled down into Gorthland so that they would have some stability through school years. I mean, I could have gone and worked abroad, but. So I'd had a passing interest in folk music from probably the revival, I think. I think my first sort of touch base, if you will, with folk music was, there used to be a thing on Teesside called the Teesside I Steadford. It was called Intertie. And it ran, the first one I think was 1966, and it was on ICI's Plainfields, and at the time I was an apprentice electrician with Dorman Long in the Seaworks, and they'd got all these choirs and dance troupes from all around the world, and they came into the, I remember them coming along and said, we've had a look in the your CV or whatever the devil they call it, and you did 5 years of French, didn't you, at grammar school? Yeah. Right, you need it. What for? Well, you're going to be the translator for a group of French people, this choir, you say. No. No, you get the week off work, really. Oh, well, that's a good job. That's either a real good job. And so for 5 days, I was a translator for this group from the Basque Pyrenees. And I was to meet those people from that region, probably 1996 would be the next encounter with people from the Basque Pyrenees, a sword dance team. We went to there was a blinking great marquee, and in this marquee on this particular night, there was Martin Carthy and Dave Swarbrick were playing, Cyril Tawney was singing, and Julie Felix was mainlining. And I sat there at the back of this hall and thought, this is unbelievable. This is like, yeah. And then a friend of mine, he sadly passed away 2 years ago, this lad called Vin Garbutt, and he was called the Teesside Troubadour, and he was to folk music. He really was probably one of the leading folk artists in the world. But he was not just a good singer and songwriter, he was an extremely funny raconteur. And he spent more time laughing than he did singing. And I grew up with him. And I can remember, this started a folk club in Eston. And I used to bob along occasionally. And then another pal of mine, he joined a folk group called the Teesside Fettlers, who were quite famous in the day. Old Frankie Porter. And then when I ended up as an engineering, because I went through an apprenticeship and day release and all that good rubbish, and I eventually ended up as a senior electrical engineer with the then British Steel Corporation, and one of my compatriots, a fellow engineer, he actually sang with the Teesside Fellas. He was an electronics engineer, so I sort of, you went in and you went out of it again. So when we landed in Gorthland, I can't remember what happened. I got dragged along to a practice one Tuesday night, and they said, that and that and that, and I watched the lads dancing and said, right, we're off on whenever it was. We're dancing at the old folks home at Pickering. Oh, yeah, can you, you can come and you can carry the banner. Oh, all right, well, I don't mind, I'll carry the banner. No. So I got the job of carrying the banner. Yeah, what they didn't tell me was there was only five of them, indeed six to dance. So I'm standing there counting, going, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Where's the other one? It's you. You're in. And that was my introduction to sword dancing, and that was at Pickering, I know, on Hatcase Lane, there's a North Yorkshire old folks home, right on the corner. And as you're going into Pickering, on your right hand side, top of the hill, just before you drop down, it's called Hatcase Lane, and it was there. And that was my first introduction to dancing out with the plough stots.
That must have been quite daunting.
It was and it wasn't. You got into it, and it's, I don't know, it just sort of stuck. It was one of those things that stuck with me. The history, I like history. History was one of my favourite subjects. And when we moved here, we tried to embrace the community. We joined in all sorts, as you do. My wife joined the Young Wives Club and all the other good stuff, the Badminton Club. And I joined the Flower and Veg Show and on the committee. And it's all the stuff you do in it. But the plough stots was one of those things that just stuck with me. And it just, because of its history, that was the first thing. And it's then its cultural significance to this area. And then the more you look, the more you find. The more you find, the more you look. And it became one of these things that, if you will, a hobby turned into a bit of an obsession. It's not a total obsession, but it became an obsession. And you start asking questions, you know, well, you suddenly discover, for instance, that nearly all of the villages around here had sword dance teams. So there was a sword dance team at Ugthorpe, there was one at Aislaby, there was one at Slights, there was actually a team at Ravenscar. And then, of course, there was a big sword dance contingent in East Cleveland, at Loftus, Boosbeck, all around there, Lingdale. So they all had sword teams. What is interesting was that the more you dug into it, you suddenly discovered that the majority of the teams in East Cleveland owed their very existence to a man from Gothland. He was a miner, and he moved from Gothland to Egton, and then he went to Loftus to work in the mines, and he took the dance and he took the dances with him. And obviously they changed them, but he took the sword dancing to an area where there wasn't. And so you dig into the history of the team, and all sorts of things get thrown out. And I suppose you suddenly realise that it has a cultural significance, and it has a significance to a lot. At that time, and we're talking 1980, 81, through the maybe latter part of 1996, 97, 98, there to there, maybe slightly later. But certainly it had a bigger significance to older people who were born and brought up in the village. Many of them considered that their year, in fact I do, their year didn't start until the plough stots had been round. I passed by. So we have the blessing of the plough ceremony, which is even more interesting because our year starts with the blessing of the plough ceremony. Now most people think plough Sunday is fixed. It's the first Sunday after Twelfth Night, and everyone will tell you that. Well, it isn't actually. If you know what you're doing, it moves. It's always the first Sunday after Twelfth Night. But if Twelfth Night is a Sunday, it moves to the following Sunday, which moves it back a week, if you will. And I think the latest can be something like the 19th, 20th of January, there or thereabouts. But most people will tell you it's around about 5th, 6th of January. And I remember telling them, we got a priest in charge. That we don't have a vicar anymore. That's another thing, you see, in the village. We got a priest in charge, and Ed said to me, it was always a big thing. When's the plough Sunday? And I was telling Ed, And I said, it's so-and-so. And he said, no, it's so-and-so. No, 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 you're wrong, Ed. It's whenever it is. Well, how do you know? Well, I just do know. Well, who told you? Well, I don't know. It's one of those things that was passed down. It's verbal history. Yeah. It's not written history. It's verbal history. So I didn't know, but Ed had he had some job with the history of the church. I don't. He got canonised for it. I think he should have got fired as well, but he got canonised as well. He come back about. You know when you get these odd conversations. I was standing in the post office, and in Bull's head, he looks at me. And says, "You're right." And you know when you think to yourself, "I'm right. What am I right about?" You're right. You're right about Dear Dance and Plough Sunday. I said, "Why are you telling you?" And he said, "But I didn't believe you." I said, "Well, why would I tell you an untruth?" Well, he said, "I went back and checked," he said, "and I never knew all these years. I didn't know." And I said, "Well, that's what you get." And so, you know, my year starts after, if you will, notionally, the year starts according to the government on the 1st of January. You know, our year starts after the blessing of the plough ceremony. And interestingly enough, they reintroduced it in Ripon Cathedral a few years ago. But them being them, I mean, you can see from here, our little wooden plough on the top of our display. I mean, that was made in 1923, and that cost £1.26, I think, or something like that. It was made by a village joiner. Yeah, not like that in the big cathedrals, is it? You take a big John Deere and a blinking great power harrow in behind and park it in the main transept, you know. Yeah, they have to go one better, don't they? You know what I mean? And you think to yourself, way. And they said, because it was the first year, and they said, "Will you lot come down and dance?" "Well, when is it?" "Well, it's so-and-so." "Well, you can't." "Yeah, but the archbishop or the bishops asked you." "I don't care." "What do you mean? You've got to go." "No, we don't. We're having ours in St. Mary's. That's where it's always been." "Oh, you turned him down?" "It was a bishop of Ripon, I think." "Yeah." And I think people were mortified, and you think to yourself, "Well, he's just a bloke or a woman. It's no difference. It's just that as far as we were concerned, I was took precedent because that's what it had always been." Man, I have to say, I don't know what it was about Govan. It must have been something in the water because we kept changing priests or vicars, and we got another one, and for reasons unbeknown, he decided one year we would have the blessing of the plough ceremony at 6 o'clock on the Sunday night. Well, we never said no. You know, no was said. And we would go to church, and we went to church, come out. And we stood at the back of the church. And now John Smales comes up and, "What's the matter, lads?" "What's the matter?" "What do you mean, what's the matter?" "We'll have a conversation tomorrow." So he rang us up. What's the matter with you lot? "Why? What's this going to church at 6 o'clock on blessing the plough?" "Well, he told us it was all right." I said, "Well, it wasn't all right." I said, "And no one asked us." I said, "It's 10 o'clock, St. Mary's, on a Sunday morning. Not when you think it is and not when he thinks it is. We put up with it this year, but we're not buying it next year. Leave it with us." Anyway, the vicar rang us up and apologised. He said, "I hadn't realised." So, well, and that was the only time. I mean, that.
You still do that now, don't you?
Oh yeah. We still the blessing of the plough ceremony is that's the start of the year. We haven't had one for the last couple of years because of COVID, of course. And we weren't doing one of these distance Zoom carry-ons because that just didn't mean anything. What they used to do in years gone by, I mean, the team itself, the modern team owes its very existence to a chap called F.W. Dowson. Francis Wrightson Dowson was his name. And he was born at near Woth in the village. He was one of the founding part founding members, I think, or he wrote an awful lot for the Yorkshire Dialect Society. He wrote an awful lot of stuff for them. Interestingly enough, certainly in Where Did I Go Hunting, I think I went into Teesside Library and I went into York Library looking for some of his stuff. And it's all gone. Somebody beat me. It must have been pinched, you know, taken out of the reference parts. It just disappeared, and it wasn't there. But Dowson was what they call a pupil teacher. He went to Gotham Primary School, and in 1896 he became a pupil teacher, as it was called. And then he went off to London, where he got a BA, and he was a teacher in London. But his first wife was a sort of an ill lady. What did they call her? Francis? No, I can't remember her name. I've got a name down somewhere. And she was not a very well lady. And he decided he would move her back to the countryside for fresh air, because fresh air cures you, apparently. So he moved back to the family home at New Wath. And one of the things was that was always said, you see, this is part of why of the team, was that he was a retired school teacher. Well, he was, but he didn't retire until something like 1937. When he moved back to Gotham in 1919, he actually still kept on teaching. And you think, how did he do that? Because he was in London. Because oddly enough, I'm writing the history of the team, and I was given, somebody rang us up at New Wath. Roger rang us up. He says, I've got something you might want. In fact, I think it's in our archives, hanging up over there. And it was actually his vellum, it was Wrightson, Frank Dowson's vellum script of thanks for service from London City Council. And he actually didn't retire till 1937. And what he obviously did, he went to Gotham Station, got on a train, and he went to work in London. He must have had a flat in London. He was commuting from 1919 to London and back, because in those days you could get on a train in Gotham and go anywhere. So this modern notion about commuting from Leeds to London or wherever to London or wherever, they were doing this pre that, in, you know, sort of lots of people. I mean, the one thing that most people don't realise is it's turning about Gotham is that there was a lot of ship owners lived in Gotham. There were principals of, and there were small coasters as well, 3,000 tonners, 4,000 tonners, that sort of thing. And they lived here, and the house I live in was owned by a ship's chandler. And it was obviously why he lived there, because all the people he dealt with who owned shipping companies, they all lived in Gotham. And he had offices in Hull, he had offices in Newcastle, and offices in Hartlepool and Middlesbrough. He could go down to Gotham Station, jump on a train, and get wherever he wanted to go, go to work for the day, and come home, and he was doing it by train. You know, and you think to yourself, and we think we so clever, and we not, because they were doing it before we even got there. We aren't even at the races, seriously, we're not. So Dowson decided that he would reform the team. Now, obviously, being village-born, he knew what had gone on, and he knew a lot of the people. So he called a meeting in the... Because it's always puzzled me that people... Everything you read is he reformed the team in 1921. No, he didn't. What he did, he called a village meeting in the Easter of 1922. And he wanted to know, was anybody interested? And that's how the team was reformed. Because it stopped dancing in 1886, I think it was. We stopped there or thereabout, 1886, I think it was. We stopped dancing. And he called this meeting, and people turned to him, and I think it's written down somewhere, that, and they brought forth their artefacts. And some of the artefacts we still have that were brought out at the meeting to reform the team. And it took him from the Easter of 1922 until the January of 1923, which is when the team went out again. He went out to dance for the first time. And you think, well, that took a long time. Well, it's obvious why. Half the time he was in London teaching. And the other thing that had happened in Gotham, that most people haven't grasped. They write it, and that they don't understand is sort of from. Gotland was always a tourist village. It grew up on tourism. So this notional myth that a TV series found us and we became this tourist epicentre, it's just cobblers. Because those two railway lines came in, people came here to walk and stay, that's what people did. And the Malian Hotel was built in 1896 to accommodate the people who wanted to come to Gotland on holiday. I mean, there was a 9-hole golf course went through the middle of the village. I mean, can you imagine it, playing golf? Nowadays, you know, oh, BMW 3 Series, it's mine, straight through the windscreen. You can imagine it, can't you? far from it being somewhere that was off the beaten track, it very much wasn't off the beaten track, and it was a tourist village. And what happened was, we went from what you would call a peasant economy, where you had a few people had all of the land, and everybody else sort of bumbled along, and they were poor. Let's not kid ourselves. Poverty was endemic. If you actually read some of the things I've read about, but they were happy poor. No one was better than anybody else because nobody had anything, by and large, better than anybody else. But obviously, opening up the Malian and the big houses, which most of them, a lot of them were built as to take tourists in all year round. So jobs became more available. So people, instead of, I don't know, walking around in the snow looking at sheep, suddenly got jobs working in hotels, chauffeurs, and maids and cooks and stuff like that. And of course, because we were fairly isolated, and we were, that's one of the reasons why the Ploughstots existed and kept going, because we were isolated. You know, there's not a lot to do in Gotland on a winter's night. Trust me, it's bleak and it's dark, and when the wind whistles down the Darnholm Road, you get wet if it's raining, and it blows horizontal at you. So that was one of the things. So labour, if you will, was imported, brought in, or taken from the people in the village. So jobs were plentiful. So people couldn't get the time off that they maybe could have years ago, please themselves whether they were going to go and turn out and do a bit of flint napping or in the quarry or something like that. And that's why it took so long to get the team mobilised. So they went out in sort of 1923. But if you actually look at the team itself, and you actually look at some of the stuff that Dowson wrote and some of the artefacts, and the estimates of the age of the pot watch. Now, the pot watch was, he reckoned, in about 1923, was about 150 years old. So it doesn't take a great quantum shift back over to think, well, actually, you can get around to about 1756, 1760, is probably the mark of when the team was actually dancing. Although there's nothing written. The first written word about the team is 1812, isn't it? It's in Dr. White's book, The History of Whitby, or something like that. It's in there somewhere. But one of the interesting things about sword dancing is that there is a set of sword dances on Papa Stour up in the Shetland Isles. And a good friend of mine, George P. He's a good Orcadian, is George. Now, he's a retired schoolmaster now, is George. And he's adamant that the sword dances that exist, because it's very interesting. You've got sword dances around this area, in North Yorkshire, if you will. There was dotted around elsewhere, but there was an awful lot. The Vale of York, you know, there's dances named Eskrick, Rickall, Poppleton, you know, around the York area. So there was, if you will, sword dancing in these areas. There was lots of sword teams here. And then it virtually missed out, the whole of the coast from Whitby, if you will, all the way to the Orkneys. And up on the Orkneys, the sword dancing. Well, the hell did they get there? And he's adamant that what happened was, and that boats going from Whitby to the Greenland Fisheries, whaling, stopped off on the way up, or stopped off on the way back, and quite often did no money when they were on the way up. So they used to go ashore and dance to raise some money, then get back on the boat and go wherever they were going, Greenland Fisheries, then come back again. And you think, actually, that makes an awful lot of sense as to how a set of sword dances. And it's only there, Papas Tower. It's nowhere on the Orkneys. It's nowhere else. There ain't any in Edinburgh. You know, there was a bit notionally in Perth, the Perth Glovers. There was a bit round there. But notionally, that's it, of all the ones that are known. And coincidentally, we had the lads from Papas Tower down here about 5, 6, 7 years ago. We gathered all the, what we call the traditional teams, which would be Gothland, Flamborough, Papas Tower, Handsworth and Grenaside. And we gathered them all up for one weekend to pull together the 5 traditional sword teams of the British Isles, the ones that are known. But Gothland, by its very nature, Gothland Plowstots, has got the oldest, it is the longest surviving sword team. Yeah, we stopped dancing in 1886-7, and it was really odd. When we were building this community hub where we sit now, I got talking to a lady, and we were talking about something else, and her name... Now, through the 50s, she wrote a book, if you will, a journal of the history of the village, of varying things, with photographs and things like that. And she comes from a very old Gothland family, the Slighthomes. That's Slighthomes with an M, not an E. And there's still some of them left in the village, and they go back hundreds of years. And so she had access to what I call oral history. Family oral history counts for a lot. And it was, she got this, it's in an old pile over there somewhere, and she turned around and said to me, "Do you want this book? Because if you don't, I'm going to throw it away." And it's something she wrote. I said, "Yeah, I'll have it off you." So I got this book, and you just have a look at it, don't you? It's out of curiosity more than anything. And then all of a sudden, in there, in writing, this mystery of why the team stopped dancing is there. And it was all to do with what they call the magic pegs. And they used to go around into Whitby. And it got quite violent. I don't know whether most people know, but one of the things that the teams always did is they went out on what they call a plough tour. Now, the plough tour always followed. After the blessing of the plough ceremony on the Sunday, the team would go out on tour for a week, for a fortnight. They would just go. They wouldn't come home, they would go. They were quite cute, actually, because if you start looking at it, you think, yeah, that daft you lot, were you? They would go from here, and they'd probably go from here to Slights. Well, I know they did. From here to Slights, just imagine, you're on foot. And they would walk there, and then they went from Slights to Farlingdales. Well, on the rock top side of Robin Hood's Bay, then drop down into Robin Hood's Bay, then they wandered off. And this is walking. This isn't the Norsen Trap. These are walking people. I mean, the other one that's well known, documented, is the man on the grey horse and the brass band. And he preceded a company of 100 people, all marched from Gothland to Whitby to dance. And that's well documented. And so what happened was, there was a lot of competition. They used to always end up at Whitby on the Saturday. And latterly, when they were dancing, the money that they collected was for Whitby Hospital. Because there's some pictures in it, says, "Help us to help hospital." And the money they collected, that was another thing, you see. What did they do with this money? And it was always, the money on the Saturday was always ring-fenced. And it was ring-fenced to buy medical care. Because obviously there was no NHS. So the money that they gathered up on the Saturday, particularly, was very important, because it was a bit like your very own health cooperative in the form of vouchers that the Ploughstots got. And it wasn't just for the team members, it was for team supporters and people in the village who, you know, you'd pay for the doctor to come out or the midwife or whatever. They didn't have any money, and that's what this bought. It bought, and the other thing, interesting thing is, these tickets, they bought these, like, they were like tickets, I assume. It was like a raffle ticket, I really don't know. At one point, it was buy one, get one free. At one point, it was really, really strange. And that's what they used it for, to buy healthcare for people. So there was a lot of competition, and of course, the fishermen's wives, and there's plenty of pictures of the Ploughstots dancing up the ginnels in Whitby. And what they used to do was get the farthings, and they'd put them on the top of the stove and heat them up. I mean, heat them up. And then sling them out the window. I don't know what they picked them up with. And of course, the dancers would be going to get at them, pick it up, and of course, burn your hand. And then they'd be upstairs, look out the window, laughing at them as people would picking up these farthings that were, these coppers that were red hot, but you didn't know they were red hot because they were brown, weren't they? Oh, they were quite cruel. but there was a lot of competition for this money in Whitby on the Saturday. In fact, I think if you go into probably about, 1884, something like that, in that era, there was, the Whitby Gazette used to publish this thing years ago. It was 25 years ago this week, 50 years ago this week, 100 years ago this week. And in one, I think it was 87, it was all about Gothland Ploughstots met Ugthorpe Ploughstots on the dock end at Whitby, and a fight ensued. They were really fighting each other, and a lot of them ended up in court for disorderly conduct and fighting. And it's quite, you know, they used to write this stuff years and years ago, flowery writing and what have you. And that's what they did. So it's big. So, but they used to take these, so the competition for money was quite intense. And they used to have these collectors called Magi Pegs. They used to go rattling tins up around you. And it got out of hand. They were going into people's houses and crawling in through bloody windows when the doors were shut. And it really got out of hand. And at the time, when you dance, the king of the team was always the biggest man in the team. He was the tallest and the biggest. And the reason it was, Ralph Noble was king of the Ploughstots for years. I reckon he was about 6'4", something like that. Big farmer. Because he could keep them all in order. He kept everybody in line. You did as you were told, and you behaved yourself. Because when he packed in, nobody could keep this lot in line. And it got that much out of hand. They just said, we don't want to know.
And so was this documented in the diary?
She wrote it down, that's what, yeah. And it was, and of course it would have gone out the window. Well, it would have been burned for posterity. You know, it'd been just never there no more. So that answered one. I got, by default, I found out that Dowson actually didn't retire till 1937. I also found out as well, I know you shouldn't say this, but it don't matter. But there must have been something in the water in Gotham, because every time the odd wife popped off, the bloke was married usually within about 3 months. It staggered me. You know, you think, dear Lord, I think his wife pegged out in the April or something like that. I can't remember, something like that. And he was married again in the September, and he married the nurse he brought in, Ellen Bracegirdle. Well, but she was known as Nellie, but her name was Ellen Bracegirdle. So Dowson's second wife, because I've only latterly found this out. No, there's things you regret that I didn't do. I didn't realise that until the late 80s she was still alive and living in Slights, and I could have gone and I could have spoken to her. You know, there's things that I wished I had done, but I didn't do. There's things I did do, and I'm glad I did, in that I spoke to, you talk about the Ploughstots and the Plough Tour. I actually was very fortunate to speak to probably, certainly the last living at that time, member of a Plough Tour, which was a chap called Alwyn, Grayson, who's always known as Boy, Owen, Boy Grayson. And I spent some time with Boy, talking to him about the plough tour. And you get an idea of what went on, where they went, and what they did. And you got paid according to the number, on the plough tour, you got paid according to the number of days you went. And this was always after the deducted expenses for a set of clog irons. Because most of them wore clogs. So that you get any repair work and stuff like that, you get paid for. Any expenses were taken out. And then what was left was divvied up between you and the rest of the dancers. And it was depending on your age and the number of days you went out. And it was really strange about this because I don't know when it would be. 1991, 92. I've had a sleep since then. We were down on the Iron Bridge at Shropshire, you know, on the Iron Gorge, and we'd been in the pub the night before, or on the Friday night. Anyway, it's a long story. I volunteered to be barman, and the lady said she'd rather pay me than feed me beer. I can't understand that. Anyway. And we danced across the Iron Bridge, and me and our dog, we were just, Marky Wally, he was chairman, we were leaning on the railings, looking back across the Iron Gorge, and they were dancing on the bridge and over the other side. This old chap just sidled up and he said, "I know you lads are." "Aye, right. You're Gorth and Ploughstots." "Here we are." "How do you know?" "Well, last time I saw you lads dance was 1937. Me dad was the auctioneer at the Irene Fair in Pickering." And you think back, you say, in 1937, people went and stood in a field and they went along and they said, "I'll have you, I don't want you, I'll have you, I don't want you." And then lo and behold, there was a bit in the Whitby Gazette, because there used to be a hiring fair at Pickering. There was also one at Egton, because Egton was a big trade centre. There used to be big markets at Egton. And it was one of those where they went from Whitby, they went from here, and then they went from Egton across the moors over to Pickering, rather than go on the road that there is now, because that was a toll road. So they did anything to avoid paying tolls. They trekked across the moor. That's what they did. And there used to be a hiring fair at Egton as well. And it was, this particular year, it was again something in the Whitby Gazette. And they would be mourning the fact there was a lack of undermaids and scullery maids or something like that. And you think, dear Lord above. No. And we're not talking hundreds of years ago. We're talking relatively modern history. And actually, if you think about it, we're about got there now with these zero-hour contracts, you know. We're actually, if you actually equate it, we've actually got back to what was going on. The only thing was, at the hiring fair, they hired you for 11 months. At least you got some certainty. You know, you got divvied up, and you'd got a job. And that was another reason that people went ploughstotting, you see, because they all came home on a certain day in November, and they were paid off till the hiring fair came round. So they had no income, so they went sword dancing. And whatever they got, they shared between them. And that's what kept body and soul together. I suppose...
Can you tell me a bit about the name?
Gorth and Ploughstots.
Yeah.
Well...
How it got its name.
Why? A stot is a Yorkshire dialect for a draft animal, usually a bullock. And it would be for the Gorth and Plough Stots, Gorth and Plough Jags, Gorth and Plough Boys, who would pull the plough, which would be the mini plough that we have. That's what we've got a set of traces for that, and you can put the kids in it, and they can pull that around. But that's what it would be for. That's how the name came in. I mean, what you have to understand is that all sword dancing is an evolution. At one time, there was the Gorth and Mumming play, and there was the sword dancers were part of the Mumming play, which was only ever performed, I think it was Easter Sunday, And apparently it was about two and a bit hours long, and it was filthy. I mean, lewd. Lewd and crude. And it probably appealed to the sense of humour at the time. And so they used to do a bit of an act, and then in would come the sword dancers and do a dance. Then they'd go out, and then the play would continue. Then back in would come the sword dancers and go back out again. And they went in and out of it. The reality of life is, part of it were mating dances because there's a cushion. Part of it's a cushion dance. If you read it, read the bits you know, that's still there. In actual fact, it's not dissimilar to the Ampleforth mystery play, or mumming play, for want of a better word. And that's probably because there was a guy called, what did he call? Was it Reverend John or something like that, who used to ride around the parishes, and he was one of these wandering vicars, you know. But he had a bike. Apparently, he didn't come on a horse. He had one of these bikes where you sit on it and you sort of didn't have pedals. Don't know what, you know, you sort of you steer it, move it, you flap your feet side to side, a bit like a balance bike that children have now. If you think about it, a balance bike is nothing more than what they were riding in 1800 and frozen to death. Well, he used to come around, and what they say is that he brought these mystery players, these mumming players, were brought by him to this area. He brought them in. Now, I don't know whether that's right or whether that's wrong. That's what's written down. And certainly, Dowson, he bemoaned the fact that he knew a lot of the people who were the last people to perform the Gotham mumming play, and that was at Beckall, outside the Lord Nelson. He knew them personally. He'd spoken to some of them, but he was that busy doing other things, because he was obviously working in London, looking after his wife. I don't know what he was doing with the maid, or the nurse, and reforming the team and writing stuff for the Dialect Society. He was one busy boy, and he rues the fact that he never spent time going to talk to the people he had the opportunity to speak with, because what happened was the words of the Gotham mystery player were burned. I mean, that's well documented. They were kept in somebody's house. She thought when they were clearing the house, when her mother had died or something, that nobody wanted them, so they burned them. She didn't ask very well. In actual fact, nothing changes. Nothing changes at all. I was doing something not long ago, and this particular person said to me, and they were an old, they came to Gotham in 1896, 7. They had a big house built, Thwaitefield, and her father was the principal of the Roland Steam Shipping Company that ran out of Sunderland. And Mr. Rowlands, he actually died in St. Mary's Church at the service. And if you go past St. Mary's Church and you look up, there's a clock. Yep. That was put up by his friends of his in his honour. And the stained glass window at the far end. And that was all money. That's how much money there was floating around the Whitby area. They weren't cheap. You know, a clock wasn't cheap. And that they installed in his honour. He was sort of the person that helped, if you will, restore the team. But as an organisation, what we try to do over the years, I have anyway, is try and keep what I call the tradition going. The thing that's always struck me, because I have been all over dancing with the team, abroad and what have you, and we've also met many teams from abroad, and it's really odd. In terms of sword dancing, Gotham Ploughstots are revered. It's really weird. I kid you not. We went to America in 2015 to dance in Boston, and it was like, you'd think we were the Holy Grail had turned up. You know, it was us lot. You know what I mean? It was really, really weird. You know, I've got to come and see Gotham dance. Really? Oh, well, if you insist. I mean, and it's lovely. And the one thing it has done is that I have noted is that, particularly with school children, where we taught it in the village school, in that it taught them teamwork, that six were needed to dance, you couldn't dance with five, and it taught them social cohesion and responsibility, which is very important. Sadly, we got a headmistress and the changed the curriculum, and she decided that we weren't welcome anymore. We were persona non grata. And she didn't realise that the damage she did then, because up until then, we were going into school once a week, teaching the sword dances to everybody. And that's how, if you teach, was it Ignatius Loyola who nailed the Roman Catholic Creed, didn't he, to the door? Was it Antwerp Cathedral or something like that? He nailed it to the door. And what did he say? Was it, give me a boy of 7 or 9 and I'll give you a Catholic for life? That's what he basically said. Now, if you get 10 lads, or 10 people now, 10 girls, students, in your village, and you teach 10 of them, you will undoubtedly keep 1 or 2 of them. You won't lose them all, but you'll keep 1 or 2 of them. And the other thing it does is that there are some people who are not very academic. Some people aren't particularly musical. But in dance, because of the way it's dance, it gives them a sense of belonging and a sense of purpose and a sense of being a part of an organisation. Now, she wrecked that, this particular head teacher. I ain't going to name her. But that's what happens, you know. And trying to put that back in, we're trying to undo 25 years of nothingness, you know. And of course, now we're competing against blinking the electronic games and all of that. You're competing against that. So what we do as a little group is, what we were doing is going around all the local schools. There's a little band of us, go around teaching sword dancing. And it's gone down really well. Or it was going, I'll rephrase that, it was going down very well until this pandemic stepped in and cream cracked everything. And it did. So hopefully we'll get that back again in due course. But obviously as a team, you know, we've evolved and changed. And things change. We dance women. 2010, we just made a change. I mean, we're the only team that got kicked out the Morris ring, actually. That was even funnier. About, I don't know when she would be, I don't know, 1980, something or other, this lady rang us up and says, "My daughter can play fiddle, but she needs to play for a dance team, and she needs to learn the discipline. Will you take her on?" "Yeah, all right, bring her up." And this very strangely attired, garbed young lady turned up. That she could play the fiddle was indisputable. She was very strange, garbed though. Anyway, that lady, that girl, isn't it, was it became a mum and a lady, is Eliza Carthy. Eliza Carthy came from the Waterson Carthy family. Probably the first people of folk worldwide, I'd guess. And Eliza was our fiddler. Fiddles with the team. She's fiddled with us for a long time, you know. A lot of these, at the time, the Morris ring, you couldn't take a woman with you. And we used to get invited. And we said, "All right, great. We're bringing Eliza with us." "Oh, no, you can't bring a woman." Well, it works like this. Either she comes with us, or we don't come. It's as simple as that. I'll ask you the question. What's that? If Eliza Carthy turned up and said, "She wants to play for your team, would you turn her down?" "Well, you know." "Well, we didn't either. So we're not coming to you." And literally, that's what happened. And we were cashiered. They say we weren't, but we were. We were cashiered out of the... I thought it was quite funny, actually. Because even funny was, they asked us to join in 1970. We didn't even ask to be joined them. They asked us to join. And then they asked us to leave. That's fair enough. You asked us in, you kicked us out. Don't matter to us. It's of no consequence, actually. We thought it was quite funny, really. We kept the stick of office. It's in there. That looks like a barber's pole. It's in there somewhere. They're not having that back. But, yeah. So, and then about 2010, the world revolves. The world changes. And the then secretary rang us up and he just said, look, Keith, this is where we're at. This is what we need to do. We need to look to dance. We need to open our team up. We live in the 21st century. Yeah, okay. That's fine. That's what we did. And much to the amusement, consternation is the word, rather, of a couple of the old sword teams. Oh, you've got women, Doctor. Yeah, well, you will surely. No, we won't, we won't. Yeah, you bloody well will. No, we won't, yeah. Guess what? Yeah, they do. Yeah, the time's marched on. Some. You know what I mean? There's no longer a bastion. Because, when I first joined, you had to be either born in the village or live in the village to dance with the team. That doesn't exist anymore. Because you can. You know? Life is transient. People move in, move away, move in, move away. And it's fair to say, without people from outside, we would struggle. We would struggle. But as an organisation, I suppose, we're as healthy now as we've ever been in terms of numbers. It fluctuates, but by and large, we're as healthy now as we've been for some considerable time. I mean, when I first started, you know, a musician was always the problem. You know, we'd dance to a gobby, mouth organ, sorry. So, be somebody on a mouth organ, and that would be it. And occasionally we got the luxury of a squeeze box, a melodeon, you know. Now we have virtually a full-blown band follows us around, which is quite nice. But we got mandolins and violins and melodeons, accordions, clarinet, we had a trumpet. We have them all. Saxophone. We have these band traipses around with us.
And how often do you practice? Tell us about the team now. How often do you practice? Do you meet in here? Do you?
Well, this is our headquarters. I mean, that's plain to see for everybody. And that's our display case over there with all our stuff in. But we haven't had a practice. I think that we've just changed secretaries. And he's about to call some practices. But I'll have a couple of practices before Whitby Folk Festival and then start from there. It's one of them things. It's like learning to ride a bike. Once you've learnt the dances, you don't really forget them, do you? It's like learning to ride a bank.
And how many dances are there?
There are 5 6-man dances and 1 8-man dance. That's called No Man's Jig. That's with the poo sets and the rolls in it. But they're all, I mean, theoretically, they are allegedly Viking fertility dances where they would dance around a runestone, sacred object, call it what you will. And then allegedly, as they tap the swords together, that drives out the evil spirits, the noise of the rhythmic tapping. Then the Hilton point, the swords that form a circle, and that keeps any malevolent spirit out. And then it culminates with forming a lock and spilling virgin blood on the floor. But we don't do that now because there's a shortage of virgins and we've given that up as a bad job. We did try, but we can't find any volunteers. But the colours obviously are pink and blue. That's the Whigs and the Tories. From the political parties of the day. There was an allegation that we danced in a sandy coloured tunic because there was a team at Egton, and that was to do with the dancing for the Roman Catholics, but that's not true. It was just, that was the colours of the tunics that the Egton team had, because obviously Egton Bridge was a centre of Roman Catholicism. I mean, that's where Oliver Postgate was from, and that's where they found his pre-soul and canonised him, didn't they? Well, they did. And so, if you go to Ecton Bridge, oddly enough, if you want to know whether a Roman Catholic lived there, just have a look to see if there's a big fir tree stuck in the front garden. That's how they knew it was occupied by a Roman Catholic, round here anyway. Yeah, it's really strange the stuff you find out as you wander around in life. I found out, what was it, not long ago, I can't remember what the bloody tree was, but if you want to know where the drains were on the land round here, the land drains, you'd just find it, and it was an ash tree or something. If you found that, you'd know there was a land drain went from there across the field. That's how they actually waymarked where land drains were. But I digress. But
has the clothing changed much other than the clogs? Do you still wear
wooden clogs? No, I can't dance around in clogs. No, wait. The only thing that we don't do is we don't wear hats. We used to wear hats. Peaked hats. And I quite liked them, actually. But they were a pain in the backside. Because when you bent down, they fell off. And the only way you could keep them on was for an elastic band or a piece of elastic and under you, like a chin strap. And then you look rather odd dancing around with your red hat on your head and this lump of knickery elastic under your chin holding your hat on your head. Where we go back to them, I don't know. I mean, we had a lot of hats. We had a sack full of them, actually. But they were all one size. Like, I think there were six and an eighth. Well, they must. But they came from the GPO, the Royal GPO, you know, posty hats. That's what they were. There must have been a lot of people in the post office had little heads, or they ordered a job lot of them and nobody wanted. We had a sack full. I mean, we literally had we must have had about 30 of these blessed things in a sack. Anyway, they went a journey. They got mouldy and went a journey. But no, and they're expensive. You know, I mean, to give you an idea of you say about the team, the last set of swords we had made, I think they were £80 a sword. So, and we had, I think they were £80 a sword, and we had 16 swords made. So you do the math. A tunic's 50 quid, set of trousers 30 quid, 35 quid. It's not cheap keeping a team on the road.
The swords get passed down.
Oh yeah, the swords are, we keep the swords. They didn't years ago, they used to take them home with them. Years and years and years ago. But not now. We've got probably about 5-6 sets of swords. I made a set, actually. In fact, I made 2 sets that we occasionally use. And then I made a couple of sets that are out in America. And there's another set used over Woodhullsfield way. I used to work at a College of Further and Higher Education. I came from out of the steelworks, an engineering background. He got pretty averse at using all sorts of machinery. And there was times in the engineering workshops when nobody was using anything, so it was help yourself time. You know, there was the steel there, the handles were there, bit of school degree and off you go. It just passed the time of day away. It is an expensive hobby. It's not cheap keeping the team on the road. Not anymore. We run a 200 club where we've 4 draws a year, and we offer so much money first, second, third. I think we give 200 or 300 quid away each draw. Then we have a double up draw at Christmas, and that nets us a couple of thousand quid a year, and that goes into the pot for just keeping body and soul of the team together.
What's your plan for the future of the Power Stocks? Where would you like to see them in another 100 years? Yeah.
Well, I like to think the tradition continued. Mm-hmm. I think that's why we built the community hub. That's why we got the exhibition. That's why I've written the book. That's why, if you will, I'm being interviewed. That's why it's all in the Vaughan Williams Library in Cecil Sharp House. It's to keep it there. The thing that always gets me, I'm always struck by, is that I was in 1996, we ran an international sod dance spectacular in Scarborough. We've had a few more since then. And what always intrigues me is that when you get a team from, say, Italy or Spain, and I was alluding to, we had some teams come up from the Basque Pyrenees to dance, sod dancing. To their region, and Germany, to their region, their town, their city, whatever it is, that's an honour to be invited to our festival. So their town, city, region, whatever they are, paid for the transport and even gave some of them spending money just to come. It was an honour to come. We lack a tradition. I'm sorry, we do. It annoys me. It's awful and it shouldn't happen, but it do. People, and it's usually the mainstream media, have a go at Morris dancing and stuff like that. They don't understand this. This is a million miles from them. They have no cultural idea at all. Even worse, the local authorities, Scarborough Borough Council and bloody in the North Yorkshire Moors National Park, they have no idea what we do. None at all. They have nothing. They talk about cultural identity, dark skies. No, Gorth and Plowstots are your cultural identity. Why don't you form something round that? Nah. Talk about the railway, fine. But they don't actually talk about the things that makes up, if you will, the North Yorkshire Moors National Park. And we are part of the culture of the national parks that was there before it was created, and it'll remain probably when it's gone, because in my humble opinion, the sooner some of it's gone, the better, because they are one of the obstacles to our team. We've been trying to build social housing in this village. It was obvious to a blind man on a donkey that if you didn't put some low-cost housing, social housing, not low-cost, then the children who were born up in this village, who wanted to live in this village and bring a family up in this village, wouldn't be able to afford to buy property in this village. And that would mean that the school numbers would go down and down and down and down and down. We have a direct correlation. Our well-being is directly related to the school population. And it's gone down and down and down. And that's thanks to the North Yorkshire Moors, National Parks, planning officers. Nobody else, it's in there, it's on their toes. Nobody else. And for 30 years I've been fighting this. And, you know, that's another story. Part of what, trying to, you suddenly realise, you know, we've got this most precious bloody culture. And it's just ignored. It's just scandalous. Absolutely scandalous. And people don't understand. I mean, through dancing, I've been to all sorts of stuff that most people had never have heard of and have never been to. The mayor making of Ox Street. I've been to the well-blessing ceremonies up in the Peak District. Most people in Britain wouldn't know what the well-dressing ceremonies were and what they were for. And it's to do with the Black Plague. And the rats couldn't get into the water. And that's where the plague stopped. But most people wouldn't know. And there's all these different things that go on, the rough money, things like that nobody has any idea.
Can you tell us some of your, kind of, to bring it back around a little bit, some of your kind of favourite memories then? From being with this group, like, what are your highlights? What have you, is there something you've done that you feel like?
No, we dance, dancing on the Royal
Mount.
Personally?
Yeah.
Dancing on the Royal Albert, singing, doing the singing on song on the Royal Albert Hall stage in front of about 5,000 people when the plough starts dancing. That was, you suddenly realise that was just something else. That was just, dear God. We went to dance. It was the Watersons' 40 years, great river of song. It was their 40th anniversary from the first time they sang on the stage. And I spent the whole day, I never came outside, in the Royal Albert Hall. I went all over. I went in the gods, round the bull ring, and I went out the place. And unbelievable place. So yeah, that is probably the standout. And the Liverpool Garden Festival, oddly enough, We went to dance there whenever the garden festival was, and we went on a bus from the village. It was full. It was a beautiful hot day. The first ever garden festival at Liverpool. It was a Margaret Thatcher invention, wasn't it? And we got the oldest bus from Locker's Coaches at Lockton. And we hadn't gone 5 yard. We had heading towards Saltergate. And as the bus went along, this inspection hatch was raising up in the air, and you could see the prop shaft underneath the bus driving the back wheels. So people spent the journey to Liverpool with 1 foot on the inspection hatch, as this old coach, I mean, it was the oldest coach that chugged into the car park. I mean, it was made in 1900 and frozen to death, but it was cheap and it got us there. But to actually walk in front of there must have been about 10,000 people watching, I think, there or thereabouts. And it was a three-sided stadium, and we went on, and there was Gotham Plowstots Juniors, Gotham Plowstots Intermediates, and Gotham Plowstots Seniors, and every one of them, I was born or lived in the village. And you'll never see that again, or I suspect it's highly unlikely you would ever see that again. And I can remember that as though it was yesterday, that particular day, that particular moment, when you think, this is like just unbelievable. But we've also had lots of fun. We've had lots of fun. And I've got good friends. Sadly, a lot of them have passed over through dancing. Made friends for life and friends departed. And that's when I feel it most, in January, because we used to always walk behind the teams as we walk around the village, dancing the village, because we don't have a plough tour anymore. We dance on the Saturday following plough Sunday. We dance the village for the day. And we still have the plough stock roast beef and Yorkshire pudding on a night, and it goes on into the early hours. But me and our dog, me and Malky Wally and Michael, and the three old codgers, as we were called, we'd walk behind the team. And it was one of them days where the teams would be walking and dancing and walking and dancing, and we'd be just behind, and you'd have a nat at whoever, to Len and Vera or whoever, as they leaned over the fence, a few words, you could lean. I think there's pictures of us leaning on walls and just having a chat to people in the village, because they were the residents. You know, you knew where the holiday homes were. There was no lights and no sign of life. It's gradually got worse, actually. But you knew that. But you could chew the fat, chew the cud, put the world to rights as you paddled on. And we paddle around from 9:30 in the morning while 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I mean, I have gone home in what you might call worse for wear, because people do offer you a bit of largesse at the gates, and it's rude to say no, very rude. And yes, I've sat under the shower trying to sober up to get ready to go to the dinner on the night, which starts at 7:30, and then that goes to about 3-4 the following morning. Then he got out of bed at 12 o'clock, went back to the pub to discuss the carryings on of the previous 24 hours and the hair on the dog, and then you staggered home about 10 o'clock at night and stitched the liver back in, you know, and prayed to God for forgiveness, and, you know, and winning the raffle, you know, which was a bag of taties, and there was this had a hole in, and we knew we'd won it, because there was a potato dropped out all the way from the pub back to our house. We go on with half a sack of taties. It's time, in it, you know. Time. And I've spent hours and hours, happy days and nights. I've been away on holiday, I've been abroad, dancing. Would I change it? No. Do I think people are missing out? Yes, I do. Do I think it's important? Yes, I do. Is it vitally important? Even more. It's like life. This is part of the DNA of the village, you know. It's not what people think it is. So, It's not Bloody Heartbeat, excuse me. It's Gotham Plowstots. You know. And yeah. So, you know, if you know, in our exhibition in here, I mean, this community hub, as a team, we have about £20,000 invested in this to secure our stuff. Because we had a little place in the village and it was rotten. It was going damp and mildewed, and now it's safe and secure, and it's adding for, and they'll always be here, you know. And people can come and look at them and wonder what they are and not what they're for, and they can go through the archives and they can have a look on a memory stick of photographs. And oddly enough, I last week before? I got a telephone call or an email, I can't remember, off a lady in North Skelton, and she wanted to know, did I have some photographs of her and is a brother or uncle or somebody, and they hadn't any. And somebody was coming from Australia, and I went into my file on Lingdale, and I sent her all the pictures I had of Lingdale. And I get a message back, thank you so much, they're the only photographs we have of this chap dancing. Now, they would have gone, but the preserve for posterity, that they've now got them, so that whoever wanted them can take them back to Australia, and they've got them. So for whatever, wherever I picked them up from, you know, somebody gave them to me, and I've got them and photographed them, and, you know, that's what should happen, rather than throw stuff away. We're too good at chucking stuff away, you know, and then you suddenly realise you need it. I'm hopeful for the future, you know, always hopeful, always. I think the pandemic has set us back a little bit, certainly going into the schools, but there's a bit of a cultural upswing of people who are interested in this sort of stuff now, and that's very important, you know. I mean, we started teaching in schools again probably about 4 years ago at Broughton St. Peter's, and that's a school where I think, and this is not denigrated, it's a lovely school, and the head Richard is unbelievable head, but to have sort of 12 sets of children all dancing Gotham at one time at the school fair, now that is something. It might not have been perfect, but by hell, it was worth a watch, and it was worth a watch, you know. And then you invite them over here, you know, and we can use this facility. And I remember saying to them, well, if you want to come over in a weird day, you can come to the hood, and that's fine. And they came over, and they brought a couple of coach loads of them, well, the two minibuses from the Variety Sunshine coaches, and you know, because of the majority of them, I think 90% are on preschool meals. And I was talking to some of the teachers, gave some time and what have you, and I put an appeal in the village, come get some sandwiches and feed these children, you know. And I was just like mobbed with stuff. And excuse me. These bands that was there, some holiday one day in Gotland, that was through sword dancing. So we gave these bands an away day for a summer holiday that they wouldn't have had, you know. And people talk about sticking a man on the moon and spending 30 million quid, and these kids, their summer holiday was at one day in Gotland, and that was because we'd gone to teach sword dancing, and my daughter helped out, and she was in bits, absolute bits. You can't imagine, you have no way of imagining what it could be like. And so we take the sword dancing in, and as I say, these children through that, they could do things. We've gone into special needs school.
And the memories must be, for them, I mean, what an amazing memory.
It's what you're doing it.
Must have Which is
what you do. I mean, not now as much, but certainly when we were teaching in and around the schools. And we'd start again in shortly, probably September, in the schools in and around Whitby. It's quite unnerving to walk around and this little boy's like, "Hi, Keith! How are you doing?" And you see this mum and dad, and they see the little child saying, "Are you the man who teaches them something?" "Yeah, yeah, it's me." "Oh, they love it." And you think, yeah. It's quite unnerving wandering around Sainsbury's or Aldi and it's, "Hi, Keith." You know, because that's what you do, isn't it? But yeah, if we can keep the tradition going, then we will.
Well,